Hello again. This podcast is about questions that are all too familiar. After the latest mass shooting, this time at a public school in Florida, is this the price of protections guaranteed by the Second Amendment? Are there measures that could effectively reduce the danger? Is there the political will? We'll hear about the history of the gun control debate, the possible impact of those young people that are so fired up by the Parkland shooting. And we'll talk to a politician who asks if the victims' families are being sold a bill of goods. Adam Winkler is a law professor at UCLA. He's author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
What has changed since the latest mass shooting?
Well, what's changed is there's been an incredible mobilization, a political mobilization of students and of gun violence prevention advocates and ordinary citizens who are really inspired by this activism. For the last 30 years, the gun rights people have been much more politically engaged, politically active, and politically mobilized. And now we're finally seeing more action on the gun control side.
What does that say, given all the surveys we've seen that show that people around the country want to see more limitations on guns?
Well, I think it really can affect elected officials. You know, we're seeing companies start to boycott the NRA, pull back policies that they had for special rewards for their members, and that's because they feel the heat from consumers. And that same kind of consumer pressure could have an impact on elected officials come November if they believe there's going to be a lot of single-issue pro-gun control voters.
What about the proposals by the president and others that teachers be armed? Without discussing yet the merits of that proposal, what would it mean for the arms industry if, in fact, that were the case?
Well, it would really be a boon for the arms industry. You know, since Trump was elected, the gun industry is going through what's known as the Trump slump. Gun sales are down 10% year to date, and that's a big number for an industry. And having all these armed teachers would build in a whole new set of consumers for them to sell guns to.
Why is it called the Trump slump?
Well, it's the Trump slump because one story that we've often told is that when gun owners feel that there's going to be new gun control laws, they rush out to buy guns. And right now, with Trump's election and Congress in control by Republicans, it seems incredibly unlikely you'll get any significant new gun legislation. As a result, there's a little bit less of a frenzied buying mood among gun owners.
And yet, as you indicate, there is a movement led in large part by students that may change things.
That's right. I mean, it's really about political activism. I remember when we had universal background checks before the Senate, and Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a rookie Democratic swing state senator, said that, yeah, it's 90% support for background checks according to polling data. But if you look at calls to her office, it was 7-1 against background checks. And she said, you know, those are the people who are going to vote in my state, who are going to be politically active, who are really going to be mobilized. You know, if we can see the forces for gun violence prevention mobilize and become as politically active and as engaged as the gun rights people, it could really shift American politics.
Well, now here's a voice that has become very familiar. It's David Hogg, the student at the Parkland School and a survivor of the shooting a few weeks ago. Legislators in Tallahassee refused to meet with him and with other survivors.
The fact that there hasn't been a single bill passed, the Florida legislators are not listening to us. They're only starting to listen now that I've threatened the entire state of Florida's economy. The fact that they're only listening to that is a testament to how disgusting the political situation has gotten in Florida and across the nation. And, for example, the other day when we were at the session with them trying to meet with Republican lawmakers, only one of them met with us. We were supposed to have a day full of meetings with legislators in Florida. Only one Republican lawmaker met with us. And they want us to forget. They want the American public to forget. They want you to forget. And we're not going to let that happen.
Strong words from David Hogg, once again a survivor of the mass shooting in the Parkland school. Michelle Gay is the mother of Josephine. She was killed in another infamous incident, the Newtown school shooting in Connecticut, almost 5 years ago. She is co-founder of Safe and Sound Schools. Michelle Gay, as always, we are want to say how sorry we are to hear the reason that you founded Safe and Sound Schools, but thanks for being here to talk about it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Warren.
You have been saying for a long time the very kind of thing we just heard from David Hogg. Do you have reason to believe that it's more likely this time around that we will continue to hear this demand for change?
You know, it's interesting. The demand for change, the mobilization from the students, we've been advocating for a student voice in school safety for almost 5 years now, and we've been working with students since that time. But one of the things that we work very hard to impart on the students that we work with is the idea that, yes, we want to be looking at all options. We want to be exploring all ways to make our schools and communities safer, and certainly we can look legislatively at those options. But in terms of keeping the school community safe immediately today, that really comes down to basic security and infrastructure measures, as well as training and education for students and teachers. So that's really more our focus at Safe and Sound Schools, providing tools, resources, and education for the community. But we do quite a lot of work in terms of just empowering that student voice, that parent voice, the teacher voice. We want to hear from all of the stakeholders that are involved and deeply, you know, rooted in the community itself.
You have been a teacher yourself. We just heard that, of course, President Trump has advocated that teachers be armed. That would be a boon for the gun industry. What do you think it would mean for the safety of schools?
You know, as a teacher, I'm personally not greatly in favor of the idea. And the reason is because I just think there are so many easier, more accessible, less invasive options at our fingertips right now. I completely understand the need to get all possible options on the table, and I think that's really important. We should continue to entertain and discuss all options to keep our schools and communities safe. But we know, based on our work in the field and my work as a teacher, some very realistic, practical considerations that are going to make it really difficult for schools to really seriously consider the arming of staff.
Let me go back to Adam Winkler, our professor at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Is there evidence that the good guy with the gun is the best way to defeat the bad guy with the gun? And what are the trade-offs if, in fact, schools decide to arm teachers?
Well, we certainly don't have any kind of detailed empirical studies to tell us whether good guys with guns are the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun. One thing that seems pretty clear is that we can't really rely on the good guys with guns. There was a good guy with a gun at the Parkland school, and he didn't fire, and he didn't get engaged. And even if he had, it's not clear that he would have hit his target. Police officers who were extremely well trained only hit their target in about less than 1 in 5 attempts in an actual incident, because it's incredibly difficult to fire a weapon accurately in the high-pressure, life-or-death situation of a real mass shooting. So it's not likely that that's going to be our answer, because we've seen over and over again, a good guy with a gun is not enough to stop these things from either occurring or certainly limiting the damage as much as we could.
Michelle Gay, have you heard from teachers about whether they are eager to get into the kind of battles that Adam Winkler suggests would have to happen?
Lots of them are reaching out. Lots of them are concerned about this. Certainly some teachers are interested in the idea, but I have to agree 100% with Adam. There is no evidence that that this good guy with a gun theory is going to be the thing that solves this this problem that we're seeing in our schools. And imagine, you know, if a good guy with a gun, like the trained school resource officer that was in Parkland that day, was unable to stop the situation. And obviously, that's a longer discussion, a different discussion. But imagine a teacher like me. A tremendous amount of training has to go into being able to carry and to control and to know when to use that firearm, especially in a school building where, you know, you're surrounded by vulnerable students and teachers all the time. So we also know with our school resource officers, we work very closely with school resource officers, and school resource officers who are armed and trained in schools are far more likely to use other techniques and strategies to disarm a situation, a dangerous situation, you know, they're reluctant to fire that weapon in the school environment precisely because there are so many vulnerable people around them at all times.
And let's talk about the resources involved for a moment. It would cost a lot of money to buy the guns. We already talked about the fact that it would be a boon for the gun industry. But already schools are hurting for resources, are they not? Michelle Gay, they don't teach music as much as they used to, don't take art and other subjects.
Exactly. So, you know, on its surface, I can see why so many people are interested in entertaining this idea, but it really is not a very cost-effective solution for us. And in school world, particularly public schools, K to 12s where we serve, you know, budget is king. You know, we barely, teachers are bringing their own paper and pencils to the classroom, are buying books for students. So imagine the resources that we would need to devote to this level of training for our teachers. And where's that going to come from? Is that going to come out of our budgets for textbooks? Is that going to come out of teacher pay? You know, how are we going to make something like this work? So we see far more of our school communities that we've been working with for the 5 years that we've been Safe and Sound Schools. We see them looking for proven and practical options, but we also see them looking at a layered approach. So, you know, Adam was talking about we don't know that the good guy with the gun is the one thing that could make the difference. We believe that that could help for sure, but we don't want to see anyone relying on any one thing or program or measure or device or technology or tool. We want to see a very layered approach. These safety situations in schools are very dynamic. They are evolving. They are changing. So we certainly don't want to put our eggs all in one basket. We want to make sure that schools are looking at these situations and how they can best respond and even prevent in a variety of different circumstances.
So, Adam Winkler, when it comes to the proposal for arming teachers, does it seem to be more a political distraction than a really serious proposal?
Well, it certainly does seem like that, but that's what the NRA is great at doing in the wake of a mass shooting. First, they generally try to stay quiet and not say too much, and if they say anything, they say it's not the time to talk about these things. But there's so many mass shootings, it's hard to find a window in which it actually is okay to talk about it in the NRA's view. And one of the ways they've really defeated gun violence prevention efforts in the past is by proposing instead seemingly ridiculous proposals that are guaranteed to fail, that they will not be able to get the kind of coalition around. And of course, there's no way that gun violence prevention advocates are going to support an idea that we're going to start arming teachers in every school. But part of this really reflects a different worldview. For many people in the NRA and the gun enthusiast community, they really are convinced that the only way to reduce crime is more guns. The problem is just most Americans don't agree.
They don't agree, and yet the NRA has this extraordinary power, particularly in Florida, where there is a woman who has now been profiled extensively, who is the main lobbyist for the NRA, who has worked at this for decades, and apparently has been very successful in mobilizing voters against those, particularly Republicans, who vote in favor of gun controls of any kind. So, Adam Winkler, what are the chances of overcoming that?
Well, it's going to be difficult. Look, there's a built-in structural advantage that gun proponents have, which is that gun policy is not just a policy question for them. For many of them, it's a lifestyle, a culture, an identity. They go to the gun range every weekend, and they follow the gun websites and the gun Twitter feeds, and it's very easy for them to mobilize because they can share information, and they really are intensely devoted and passionate about this issue. Whereas for many people who support gun control, it's just one issue among many. It's a policy choice. We need that kind of passion that we're seeing in the wake of Parkland to really breed the kind of single-issue pro-gun control voters that are necessary if the NRA is ever going to be defeated.
So, Michelle Gay, you certainly have the kind of passion that's necessary. Your daughter was killed in a school shooting. You now have for some time been advocating on behalf of safe and sound schools. Again, do you think that there is now something new and different that might, in fact, lead to the political will to actually do something effective? And if so, what would it be? What's the most likely thing, do you think, to maybe pass, if it's not the legislature in Florida, maybe another legislature, or maybe even in Washington?
We've been working, actually, I'm now living close to Washington, so it's a little bit easier for us to do the work that we've been doing of late in terms of informing policymakers about what's needed, how to shape and consider some of the legislation that they work so hard on. And although we're just a 501c3, we're not involved in drafting or proposing any legislation. It's certainly within our wheelhouse to provide you know, that the information and the guidance for it. So what I see happening right now, I see a focus on the safety, the infrastructure, the tools and technology, the layers of security and safety that I was referring to before. I do see some funding in the works, and I'm eager to see how that plays out. But I know there's been a lot of work on both sides of the aisle. And something unique about school safety is this is something that all parties agree on. It is an issue that, you know, that does bring everyone together. So I definitely see some very positive movement there. And I hear the words school safety far more following this tragedy than I have in following previous tragedies. So that part is promising. I think in terms of gun control legislation, I would say that what we would probably see would be kind of the easy stuff, right? I think there'll probably be some progress on accessories like bump stocks. I think there may be some progress in terms of age limitations and things like that. But as far as how far this goes, I think that remains to be seen. And to Adam's point, it really depends on how organized the voice is from the gun violence prevention side.
And back to you, Adam Winkler. The voice of the NRA has been louder and more extreme, it would seem, than it has in the past.
It does seem that way. It seems to be that the kind of fringe rhetoric that we used to see from gun advocates even more extreme than the NRA, focusing on an insurrectionist view of the Second Amendment, that it's there to protect against tyranny and give people the right to rise up, has taken center stage in the rhetoric of the NRA. Rather than focusing on self-defense from criminals, now the NRA is talking about the need for guns to fight against leftists and Marxists and socialists and all sorts of others who are anti-American globalists, he says, who are coming to get your guns and all of the rest of your freedoms, too.
Is that likely, do you think, to be taken seriously by a lot of people, or does it tend to portray the NRA as sort of desperately extreme?
Well, it does. I think it does reflect a real shift by the NRA. I think the NRA's rhetoric has changed, and I think that's part of the reason why so many of these companies are pulling their discount programs from the NRA, precisely because the rhetoric has fundamentally changed. And if you watch the NRA TV, it's filled with screeds against the left. It is no longer about gun policy. It's about a culture war.
Back to you, Michelle Gay. We heard David Hogg saying, we're not going to let them forget. You hoped that would be the case 5 years ago. And even before that, of course, we had mass shootings, and people hoped that we would never forget. Do you think that the young people are, in fact, going to be able to maintain the sort of pressure and get the sort of publicity that they have for the last few weeks?
You know, I'm hopeful because we're finally hearing from them. I think, you know, following our tragedy, youth were largely marginalized from the conversation. I just think the situation, the tragedy itself, left not only our community paralyzed, but I think in a lot of ways, I think it left American citizens paralyzed and just feeling a sense of hopelessness about what can we do? What is practical for us to do as Americans? How can we ever overcome this seemingly growing epidemic that we're seeing of gun violence in America? So I'm very hopeful to hear this fresh perspective. I'm very hopeful to see these kids taking a very mature stance and stepping up. And I'm also really excited to impart upon this whole new group of stakeholders the many, many practical things we can do in our communities and in our schools to ensure safety. Certainly, we want to support conversation and looking at a variety of options and legislation, but there are some very basic measures and some simple changes that we see working in schools across the United States. So we definitely want to get those ideas and thoughts into the hands of this activated group of stakeholders, our youth.
So what is your advice to the parents who are old enough to vote on these matters, and what can they do?
I think we have to take our cue from the kids. I think we need to be open about sharing different ideas and options and solutions. I think we need to be having conversations versus arguments. I think it's important that we all realize that we have a voice and a part in solving this epidemic of violence in our culture. So, yeah, I would say it's important that we all become involved. It's important that we become fully educated about all of the ramifications, positive and negative, about each one of these solutions that we propose, and that we not all get completely married to the solutions that we offer, because those might not be the most practical or appropriate solutions, such as arming teachers. I think it's great for us to explore all options. But as we see it as an organization, that's certainly not the ideal for most of our school communities.
So, Adam Winkler, taking our cues from the kids, that's an extraordinary thing to say politically in the United States. And yet that seems to be the major theme that's come out since the latest shooting. How do you think it works politically?
Well, I think it has worked politically precisely because they are kids. They're willing mm-hmm. to speak and unadulterated truth, and that's, I think, why people have paid so much attention to what's happened, and the kids and their voice and the exercise of their voice has been very powerful, and it's also inspired a lot of other kids. I've been approached by so many schools that want to do events on March 14th to protest gun violence. You can see that, parents don't inspire the same kind of just haven't inspired the gun debate in quite the way that these students seem to have done.
So if this continues, particularly at the local level, will it seep upward?
It might. I don't have a very... It might seep upwards. I'm not very hopeful for the chance of restrictive new federal laws on the issue of guns. I mean, after all, Congress is pretty dysfunctional on any issue, much less the most divisive issue in America. And Congress is in firm control of the Republican Party that seems still dead set against any significant gun control measures. We've seen in recent years that gun control advocates have focused instead on reform at the state level, and I think we're likely to see more and more of that in the years ahead.
The most divisive issue in America. That is certainly one way of putting it. And can the kids make a difference? We will all watch to see what happens next. Adam Winkler at UCLA, the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Michelle Gay, co-founder of Safe and Sound Schools. Great to have you both, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
So what if there is a real move to try to get gun control enacted? What would it look like? What could it look like? Let's talk to somebody who has been on the firing line. He is Mike Gatto. He is a former Democratic assemblyman in the state of California. His father was murdered by a handgun-wielding assailant, so it says in the Los Angeles Times, where he has published an op-ed indicating that he thinks that the argument on both sides is disingenuous. He has listed questions for those who would favor gun control that suggest that it is easier said than done, to say the least. Mike Gatto, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, what about a politician who favors gun control? What questions should they be confronted with?
Well, I just don't like, from the perspective of a victim's family, the idea that we are sold sometimes a panacea or a bill of goods. Politicians often say that this gun control idea or that will prevent these tragedies from happening or prevent a large number of them from happening. And I'm just not sure that that's the case. I always point out that there are about two guns for every American adult already in circulation. And so if somebody is going to pass a law after, you know, 2 or 3 years of very hard work to try to get it through Congress, and then it finally passes, and it's this big promised law that's going to solve a lot of these problems, there will still be enough guns in circulation for the problem to continue.
So where do you go from there, then? You have to ask, would you support seizure of firearms?
That is a question that I think you have to ask, and it's one that makes politicians, I think, very uncomfortable.
Other than the obvious reasons, why are they so uncomfortable?
Well, of course, that's what the opponents of gun control have trotted out. They have said that this is where the country is headed, and they've used that as a scare tactic. But I think it's even more complicated than that. You know, people often cite the Second Amendment. It's really the Fifth Amendment that comes into play on that angle. If the government essentially says that we're going to regulate something out of existence or we are going to make it so that it's illegal to hold, then there is a Fifth Amendment problem. Then the government must pay people for that private property that they are taking. And that opens up a whole new can of worms for the discussion.
So then, obviously, if you're in favor of gun control, what you're suggesting is there are very few options, if any.
I'm not saying that. I think that... And I don't mean to sound like a gun control opponent. As you said in the introduction, this has touched my family very closely.
Sure.
I think we've got a huge problem in the United States. I think we've got a huge problem with gun violence. But I just don't like to see, I think victims' families deserve more honesty in the debate. One thing we haven't even touched on is the definition of assault weapon. That is thrown around a lot. What very few people know is even the 1994 law, the landmark law by Senator Feinstein, contains 650 exceptions. 650. The characteristics of a so-called assault weapon are things like, can you mount a bayonet on it? Does it look scary? You know, and that's, we've got to do better than that. Surely the legal minds in this country can come up with something a little bit better than that. I think when politicians throw that term around, it's nothing more than a catchphrase.
That's Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's, of course, a Democrat from California, running for re-election just this year. Well, what about the fact that Dick's Sporting Goods, which is a very large company, has said today that it's going to end the sales of all assault-style rifles? Did they make clear how many exceptions there are to what they mean by assault-style rifles?
I don't know that, but I can tell you that about 50% of all guns sold, both handguns and rifles, are what's more precisely called semi-automatic. And that basically means that you can pull the trigger without having to reload a reloading mechanism. They're obviously not fully automatic. They're not machine guns. But Dick's Sporting Goods is going to continue to sell semi-automatic weapons. They have a very high rate of fire. Assault weapon, people ought to use more precise terms. An assault weapon or assault rifle is really just something that in many cases looks scary. Many of the features that make something an assault weapon don't affect the actual rate of fire.
On the other hand, Dix did say that the reason they were doing this was that they had to do something in order to try to bring a halt to the mass shootings that we have said. Is that not an honest effort then on their part? Because you say they're going to go sell the guns that can either be assault weapons or be easily converted to being them without any trouble.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the tough thing. You know, it's like I do commend politicians who want to do something. I think that's a noble and it's a very, very human feeling after a tragedy like this. And I commend a store like Dick's for trying to say we're going to play a role in this. But at the end of the day, you know, there's part of me that's also very cynical, very skeptical. And I wonder if, this was a whole lot of free advertising for that chain. They're on the top of the news broadcast, and here we are discussing them on this podcast.
What about the use of the term mental illness to be a qualifier in terms of who should be able to purchase guns? Does that make any sense to you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, we can't scapegoat people with mental health issues. There are a lot of people who might have a technical designation where society probably treats them already too harshly. And that's something we have to be very careful of. Of course, if there is somebody who has been diagnosed with a true mental health issue that would make that person violent, then of course that person should not have a gun. And I tried to make that point in my op-ed that I think, government could do a better job, quite frankly, in taking back the guns of people who have been diagnosed with a violent mental health deficiency, or people who have been shown to be violent. These are domestic abusers and people like that.
What do you think about the idea of arming teachers or other groups of people in order to try to defend against a gun assault? The argument being, of course, that the good guy with the gun is the only way to stop the bad guy with a gun.
Well, I think in most cases, that's the most clear absurdity in the whole gun debate. My experience is different than other people, but I went to a Catholic school and my teachers were nuns, in some cases very elderly. There's a lot of different schools in the United States with a lot of different teachers come in all shapes and sizes and ages. And I can't imagine giving teachers that duty, forcing them to become security guards. And I also don't think most parents want their schools to look like lockdown facilities. And, big picture, of course, in all this is, do I think schools have a role? Yes, they do. When a student has so clearly fallen through the cracks or been made fun of by his peers or has made threats, that school, that community has a role with that young man to try to prevent that person from committing a crime. Now, of course, will that community always be successful? No, it's very difficult. And the situation in Florida illustrates how difficult. That community did everything right. They called the FBI. They called the police. That was a tragedy in the way that unfolded. But, schools do play a role. I just don't think arming teachers is the role.
Our previous guests on this podcast said that they were somewhat upbeat because of the young people in Florida, the enormous amount of attention that they've gotten. They had a sense that finally, perhaps, both of them interested in gun control, they might have finally reached the ears of the politicians. Do you think that's happening or not?
I'm always very happy to see young people get involved, and I was very heartened to see the willingness to organize and really mobilize that the young people in Florida exhibited. But, I also think that, take it from an old, jaded politician, that, these type of movements can very quickly transform into a grand disappointments if we're not completely candid with ourselves. And my op-ed was an attempt to do just that. It was to explain the complexity of the problem. I cited 10 different factors, 5 for gun control proponents, 5 for gun control opponents. And I would hope that, activists from all stripes, including those young people, would read things like that and realize how complicated the problem is. I would be greatly, greatly, greatly disappointed if these young people push for change and they fight for it and they get it and they get some technical law, on the books that prohibits the sale of assault weapons that have a bayonet mount. And then a week later, there's another mass shooting. In my opinion, that would quickly teach them the things that appear in an article like mine, because, like I said, there are a lot of guns in circulation already. The assault weapon definition is very technical. And it's going to take a holistic approach to solve this problem.
You are no longer an elected official. You were, though. You were in the state assembly in California. Every elected official thinks, what if I could go higher? Suppose you were in the White House. What would you do?
Well, if I was in the White House, I would go congressmember to congressmember in the style of LBJ. And I would work to come up with some type of compromise that people could agree on. This would be multifaceted, multi-component. It would be everything from banning bump stocks, the low-hanging fruit, universal background checks. I think that can do a lot of good. It would be funding research into what we could do better and the similarities with a lot of these purveyors of mass shootings. And I would be on the TV every night reminding Americans that this is our duty, not just when we're mindful of a tragedy, but really during all time.
Once again, Mike Gatto has published an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times. It's under the title, Questions You Should Ask Politicians About Guns, According to a Politician. Today's podcast produced by Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz. Our engineers are Joel Stein and Mike Newport. I'm Armin Alney. To the Point is a podcast that you can find on Apple Podcasts, on other forums, or at kcrw.com/To the Point. Join us again and again and again.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down." But she cried again as he rode away, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."